So we will take a moment before we do our prayers, and this is prayers to be recited at teachings. Does everybody have that sheet? We'll do the we do the first four prayers, right? It's been a while since we were here. We'll take a moment to bring our minds to rest. However you do that, my favorite way is generally to take a moment to become aware of how caught up I am in my head and my thoughts, whatever activity I've been involved in. And I just bring myself to really sitting, you know, really being aware that I'm sitting on my chair or my cushion and feeling what it feels like to be in my body as opposed to wherever my thoughts are taking me. Really very physical awareness. And just feeling what that feels like in whatever space I'm in, including the cyberspace in this present moment, which, as we're going to learn today, this present moment recreates itself again and again and again. It's a different present moment every present moment. And that is sort of the crux of impermanence. All right, so we'll chant our prayers. In Buddha, Dharma, and the Sangha, I take refuge till I awaken to all the virtues such as giving. May I reach Buddhahood for beings. In Buddha, Dharma, and the Sangha, I take refuge till I awaken to all the virtues such as giving. May I reach Buddhahood for beings. In Buddha, Dharma, and the Sangha, I take refuge till I awaken to all the virtues such as giving. May I reach Buddhahood for beings. Prostrating, offering, confessing, rejoicing, urging, supplicating, whatever virtue I've collected, I dedicate it to awakening. The ground perfumed and strewn with flowers, Meru for continents, sun and moon, this imagined Buddha field offering, may all beings dwell in the pure realms, according to the different propensities of beings, please turn the wheel of Dharma, great lesser and uncommon. And now teacher prayers, the four dharmas of Gampopa. These are aspirations I make as a teacher, and we can all make them together. Dadan sem shantam che lo chisu drawers in ji laptu sol, chalam de drawers in ji laptu sol, am trulpa sowers in ji laptu sol, trulpa yeshe su chowers in ji laptu sol. I pray for blessing, may my mind and the minds of all sentient beings turn toward the Dharma. I pray for blessing, may the Dharma become the path. I pray for blessing, may the path clarify confusion. I pray for blessing, may confusion arise as wisdom. Lai ke dang lu dang nu chin ke chupum dadami ke nam dang droa kunji draki jitsam par tam che ke du daki chitento. In the tongues of Nagas, Yakshas, gods, those of demons and of humans too, in the many languages there are, may I teach the Dharma in them all. And now reminder for arousing bodhicitta at the beginning of teachings. I don't know if everybody has this sheet. I sent it out a long time ago so that we could chant it together as opposed to the teacher just reciting it. And we're also going to be looking at another thing on this sheet. And I have it set up to screen share for those who don't have it. There's a really lovely statement of impermanence by the Buddha on this sheet as well. And we're going to look at that today in the context of impermanence. But the reminder for arousing bodhicitta, as recited by Lama Nara Rinpoche at the beginning of all of his teachings. Let us begin by giving rise to the thought that in order to benefit all sentient beings whose numbers fill the extent of space, I must attain the level of perfect enlightenment. In order to bring this about, I will practice the profound Mahayana Dharma by way of study, contemplation, and meditation. And if anybody finds that they're missing any materials at any point, just email me and I will send to you whatever I failed to send to you before. So I think that brings us to our meditation. It does. Next on my list. So we're going to do a short guided meditation, about 10 minutes. And I wanted to thank everybody for accommodating the schedule change. It's very much appreciated, and I hope it works out for everybody. So we're just going to go through the two wings of awakening, and that is another thing that you should have a written copy of, although you don't need to have it for the class. And if anybody's missing it, the two wings of awakening, cultivating wisdom and compassion. Mine has notes all over it, but that's what it looks like. then let me know, because you can use this on your own as well. So we're just going to go through it. We're going to do the classic two wings of awakening. This is a meditation session that's basically the content of points one and two of the 7 points of mind training, adapted from The Great Path of Awakening by Jamgon Kongtrul, and also incorporating instructions from Lama Norla Rinpoche. So first we bring our mind to rest a little bit. We already did that, so just refresh that state of being at rest in the present moment of awareness. We could call that open awareness, where all of our senses are open. We hear sounds, we see visual phenomena, we feel tactile sensations, internal, external. We're just aware of everything that's happening, including our thoughts coming and going. And this, the ultimate bodhicitta section of this meditation will also lead us into a state of resting in the nature of mind. And however you may relate to that, whether you feel you've recognize the nature of mind or not, you're actually there. And so the work then is just to begin to recognize mind itself in the context of resting the mind. But we rest however we rest, and it develops the more we rest. So in this state of resting in the present moment and just having our senses open, and now we're going to attend to the instructions and the meditation, we contemplate the four reminders, which is the preliminary to ultimate and relative bodhicitta. So first, the precious human existence. We're just going to touch on each one, that we now have all the conditions that we need to attain awakening. They're very hard to come by, and so we need to make use of them while we have them, which we are doing in this moment. And then impermanence and death, which is our topic today. The bad news that this wonderful opportunity can end at any time without warning. So we can't take for granted that we have more time than right now. So we need to use this present moment to practice as much as we possibly can. Even in the midst of activity, we can be mindful and vigilant. Third reminder is karma, that it's our own actions that determine what happens to us in the future. If we engage in actions that are positive and help other beings, that will result in happiness in the future of this lifetime and future lifetimes. If we engage in harmful actions, that will bring us suffering in the future. And if we engage in Dharma practice, sincere Dharma practice, that will lead to liberation from samsara and the true ability to help others free themselves as well. So we can kind of see where we should be putting our our energy, our effort here. And then fourth, the last of the reminders, the suffering of samsara, that it's all suffering. And since there is no reliable happiness anywhere in confused existence, there's no kind of lasting happiness, nothing that will just, you know, solve all of your problems forever. We need to use this life not to create more opportunities for temporary happiness and pleasure, but to really free ourselves from all of it so that we can help others do the same. So that's a statement of our motivation, and we can just rest in that for a moment. Next is the brief Guru Yoga, just requesting the blessing of the Lama, requesting the blessing of whatever teacher we feel the closest connection with. And if it's, you don't have one in human form, you can think of the Buddha, you could think of Chenrezig, you could think of Jesus. They all work. Because any example, we're looking for an example of someone who has already achieved what we're hoping to achieve, who's farther along the path, who already has wisdom and compassion very fully realized. And we just, so what we do is we visualize the Lama or the teacher above the crown of our head in a body of light, radiating light, love, and compassion. And with or without words, we just request the blessing of the Lama to help us attain the same level of love and compassion of bodhicitta. And just by asking, we receive the blessing, and we really feel ourselves receive the blessing empowering our practice in this moment. And then the body of the teacher, the body of light, descends into our heart center and remains there, radiating light, love, and compassion and wisdom. And now we don't have to keep thinking about the teacher being there. We now do a little bit of calm abiding meditation just to tighten up our focus. So the instruction here in the 7 points of mind training is, with straight, relaxed posture, bring the mind to rest by counting 7 or 21 breaths. So you can count a few breaths, or you can just follow your breathing, or you can rest in open awareness, whatever method works for you to stabilize your state of calm abiding. So now, within this state of calm abiding, we're going to bring our awareness to rest in the nature of mind, ultimate bodhicitta, wisdom, in 4 steps. The first step is that we just, whatever we're experiencing right now, in our environment, internally, in our thoughts, we look at it as if it were a dream. We just step back from taking it as serious and solid. And we let it fade a little bit into a more dreamlike quality. And then the second step, we turn that awareness inward to examine the nature of unborn awareness, to look at awareness itself. This is basically the Vipassana step of the nature of mind meditation process. So what we're doing here is tuning in to our mind itself, as opposed to outer appearances. And we can, if it's helpful, we can ask ourselves a question, with or without words: does it have a color? Does our awareness, does the mind have a color? Does it have a shape? Does it have a location? And these are serious questions. We actually look for the answer, not through analysis, but just by looking. Do we see does the mind that we see have a color or a shape? Does it have a location? Did it come from somewhere? Does it go somewhere? Or you could ask, who or what is it that's aware? Where is this awareness? What is its nature? You just ask the question, and then you back off and just rest. Resting in whatever you find or don't find. And then step 3 is let even the remedy rest, release naturally, which means that whatever conceptuality may have come up through that process of looking at the mind, we let that go, and just that leaves us just resting. And that is the fourth step, rest in the essence, the basis of everything. Trungpa Rinpoche said it was like coming back to home, sweet home. Just resting. We don't question whether we're resting correctly, whether we are seeing the nature of mind. We just rest in whatever we're aware of. If your resting becomes sort of dull or gets distracted, you just come back as soon as you recognize that. Just come back and rest. No goals, no strings attached, just resting. So that very briefly is the cultivation of ultimate bodhicitta, the nature of mind, the wisdom aspect of awakening. And then we move on to the practice of cultivating relative bodhicitta or compassion, which is the other wing of awakening. And the instruction from the 7 points of mind training is practice taking and sending alternately, synchronizing with the breath. So I'll just recap that briefly. That we can start out just breathing, just noticing our breath coming and going. And then as we're breathing in, we can give it sort of a texture of dark, hot, smoky texture. And breathing out, we breathe out cool, white, or rainbow-colored moonlight. So there's kind of a hot, heavy breathing in and kind of a cool, refreshing breathing out. This is Pema Chodron's sort of order of taking and sending. So just sort of resting in awareness of breathing in and out those two textures. And as we're doing this, we can bring to mind a person or people, an animal or animals for whom we naturally feel love and compassion. Maybe somebody's having some suffering. And we really connect with our wish for them not to suffer. Our wish for their suffering to come to an end, for them to be free. And we connect that with our breathing. So when we breathe out, breathe in the heavy, smoky, hot texture, that is the suffering of that person or pet or animal. And when we breathe it in, we visualize, we think that we're really breathing it into our own body and freeing them from it. And as we breathe it into our own body, we realize that our body is so spacious that it just dissolves. Our Buddha nature, our spacious nature, our emptiness nature, it just dissolves into that. But the person is freed from it. And when we breathe out to them whatever it is that they need to be happy, to be peaceful, to be awake, to not be suffering. And so we just alternate those two textures of the thought of taking in suffering and sending out happiness. You can do it on every set of breaths, or you can do it every few breaths, whatever's more comfortable. And the important point here is to stay focused enough not to lose track of it, and to also to think that it's really taking place as if you were Chenrezig. You really have the power. And then we don't have to let go of that person or animal, but now we think of someone that we're sort of aware of, but we don't have a strong connection with. We really don't think of them one way or another. A neighbor that we don't know, a delivery person, someone in the grocery store. And we do the same for them. Whatever suffering they may have, we breathe it in as this hot, heavy, smoky texture. Let it dissolve into our vast Buddha nature and breathe out whatever they need. Breathe out happiness, peace, healing, freedom for that person we don't know very well. And now if you feel up to it, you can stay with those, or you can add someone that you have trouble with, someone that you don't naturally feel compassion for, someone you might have negative feelings toward, someone that might give you a hard time, make your life difficult, make other people's lives difficult. And if you feel up to it, you add them in. Otherwise, you stay with the easier objects, continuing the process of breathing in suffering, letting it dissolve, and breathing out happiness and peace. And we don't want to get involved in any storyline about it. We don't want it to sort of initiate a thought chain. We just let go of thoughts as they arise and just focus on presence, the presence of these people, breathing in their suffering, breathing out whatever they need. We can do this for anybody, anytime. And finally, we expand our visualization and our intention to include all sentient beings, all humans, all animals, and all the other realms of existence, everyone in the hell realms, everyone in the hungry ghost realms, all the gods and the jealous gods. Breathe in the suffering of all of them, whatever it may be. Let it dissolve and breathe out happiness, healing, peace, freedom. And we take a moment to think that all beings through this practice, including ourselves, are completely free from suffering, completely filled with happiness, and completely awakened. And we rest in that for a moment. And now we let go of any visualization, any conceptuality, back to that state of resting in the essence, the nature of everything. And as we come back to our regular awareness already in progress, we could actually go back through step one, just see everything as a dream. Everything we're coming back into awareness of as a dream. This class is really a dream, an illusion. We don't need to lose sight of that, and we don't need to lose touch with that ultimate awareness resting in the nature of everything all the time. So does anybody have any questions or comments before we launch into the impermanence chapter? So, yes, Joanne, I'm going to unmute you. Whoops.
I had an encounter this morning. Okay, a lady limping, and I pursued her. I thought that she was a woman without a home. Mm-hmm. And I finally approached her and spoke with her. She asked me if I was a nurse. I said, no. And I turned away. Of course, I said, umane pame ong, but the Tonglen didn't come to me. Mm-hmm. So I think that's what I got to work on.
Manis are good too. Omani Pame Ong is perfectly fine.
Is that all right?
Absolutely.
All right, because sometimes you're kind of engrossed in the moment, and then when you take a step back and that person's gone, then you go, oh, I should have done Tonglen right then and there.
Oh, you can do it when they're gone too. I mean, there's really no way to fail here.
All right, there's no way to fail.
You had compassion for this person, and so you're done. That's all.
I kept saying, let me just, I kept running after her because she kept limping and sitting. And I said, well, here it goes.
I'm looking forward to seeing this on YouTube, Joanne.
Okay,
that's good. That's good. It triggered like your memory. You wanted to bring your practice into it, and you feel like maybe you didn't do it as sort of efficiently as you might have wished you had, but you had compassion for her, and you actually asked her if she was okay or whatever you asked her. It's all good. You brought your practice into it, and you sent her compassion. And even if it was like the next day and you went, oh man, I should have done Tonglen, do it then. Okay. All the same. It's like it gets to the target. However it does, it gets to the person can have died 10 years ago. You know, you can still send them, you know, take in their suffering and send them happiness. And Lama Narla Rinpoche always said it, you know, it's just as effective whether the person is present or not present.
Thanks.
So she was in your awareness.
Okay. Thanks.
Anybody else? Okay, you're unmuted, Lama Jinzang.
It's important actually to remember that in the beginning with Tonglen, it's mind training. So it's not so much that you're affecting her through the Tonglen, but you're developing your own compassion and wish to benefit. But in fact, her hearing the sound of Om Mani Padme Hum is really beneficial, because they say just hearing the six syllables once plants a seed in the Dharma in their mind. So in a way, you know that there are different ways that you can benefit. So as Lama Chidren saying, you know, the person that you're using as your object in your Tonglen, you know, doesn't have to be there and can have passed away many years ago, because, you know, you're benefiting your mind and you're benefiting, you know, but you actually do personally help somebody by, they say, saying the mantras, and especially the six syllables if they hear that sound.
Yeah.
So that's all.
That's true. I heartily endorse that it's good to remember that it is about your own training, and you shouldn't expect like to cure somebody of, you know, limping, or, you know, I'm sure you didn't. But at the same time, when we do the practice, we do take it as real. I mean, we take it as real in the same way that our life is real, that the table is real or our computer is real. You know, we think we really could do this. Like we really could, we do it with the aspiration, we really could do it. But then in the back of our mind, we also know that we're training. So thank you for bringing that in, Lama Jinzang. Anybody else? Okay. I'm sensing that someone is, I forgot to mute someone, but it doesn't look that way. Okay, great. All right, so the brief recap of how we got to where we are, we're at impermanence, which is chapter 4 of Ornament of Precious Liberation, which we are doing through Ornament of Precious Liberation or Jewel Ornament. And also we're going to read primarily from Path to Buddhahood today, Ringo Tulku's companion volume. Yes, Dave.
You have Lama Jinzang unmuted.
Yes, you're right. I just realized that too. Thank you very much. I appreciate that. And I'm going to now remember to mute you. again. Yes, I can hear that rustling. Okay. You know, there's always the telltale rustling or whatever, and eventually you figure it out. So anyway, so we're using these two books and as our primary references. And so we first talked about Gompopa's life, and I've posted the class notes now for the first three or four units. So you can review Gompopa's life in, you know, in any of the books or on the website. 12th century physician whose family died in a plague, and realizing his powerlessness to help anybody, even as a renowned doctor, he turned instead to the Dharma and ended up founding the Kagyu lineage. So, and then his introduction, in which he tells us why we want to embark upon a path to awakening. Why do we want to wake up? Like, what's the problem? Is that we will be stuck in endless confusion forever, basically. It will never dissipate on its own. And the problem with confusion, you might think confusion is okay, but the problem with confusion is that it inevitably brings on suffering. And so if we suffer, we know we're stuck in samsara. When we have ceased suffering altogether, then we'll be in nirvana. And this is the path. So that's why we need to follow the path, is to free ourselves from suffering by freeing ourselves from confusion. And then we can also help other beings do the same thing. And so he begins the book with three prerequisites. The first three chapters are the prerequisites for the path. You really cannot effectively travel the path, at least not to the end, without three things. The first one is Buddha nature, the good news. We all have that. Even bugs have that. Everybody's got that. All beings, hell beings, have Buddha nature. Like, everybody has the potential to become fully awakened. But then there are, then second one is much more exclusive. You have to have a precious human existence, according to Gompopa. And that's defined very specifically. I don't have those notes up yet, but they'll be coming soon. You need to be human. You need to be in a human form. You need to be free from the 8 unfavorable states. You need to have the 10 resources. And you need to appreciate how fragile it is, that you could lose at any time, which we'll be talking about today. And it's very hard to get it again, so you have to use it while you have it. And that's the second prerequisite, is precious human existence, and using the precious human existence, not wasting it. And then the third one, Lama Jinzong, took us through that. We spent 2 weeks on the spiritual friend, the Dharma master, the teacher. And why do we need one? Because we need a guide to the path, or we will lose our way. We need somebody who knows the path already, because otherwise we could get lost. We could stray off the path. Second one, we need an escort, because there are dangers on the path and we need someone to help protect us from those dangers. And then third, a boatman or a navigator. This teacher serves as a navigator. The river, like the metaphor that's always used for the transition from samsara to full awakening is the other shore. We're trying to get to the other shore. And that's like the whole first verse of the Soti Seven Practices, right? It's about the precious human life being a boat to get to the other shore. And if we don't have, and the river like is full of dangerous currents and obstacles. And so we need a navigator to get across, to be sure of getting across. I mean, it's not that you can't make some progress without, you have to have the first two. Because the definition of precious human existence, like by definition, you have one if you can, if you have access to the Dharma and can practice it, then you have one. But the third one is the one that might seem more optional, and certainly you can do a lot with just the amount of materials we have now, books and videos and so many ways to study the Dharma, but you really need like a mentor like that you can work with to get across. So those are the three prerequisites. We got them. And so now we're actually embarking upon the path itself. This is it. This is where we step onto the path. So we are on, in Ringu Tulku, we are on page 31. The method, the instructions of the spiritual friend. So this is, so the book is divided up. We had the prerequisites, and now the instructions of the spiritual friend is like 12 chapters. It's like the bulk of the book is how to do it. And we're actually going to, Gompopa is going to introduce us to that.
to like what this is all about. So I'm just gonna read from him now on page 31. I'm going to skip around a little bit. If we are fortunate enough to have the first three conditions, why haven't we become Buddhas yet? Like, if you got them, why aren't you Buddha? Gampopa mentions four obstacles that prevent us from realizing enlightenment. So these are the four reasons we are not Buddha now. And so these are the problems we have to solve. These are the tasks. These are our missions, you know, the missions that we must accomplish in order to attain Buddhahood. So the first three obstacles, it's very good to commit these to memory. Like, this is really important information. The first three obstacles are excessive attachment to this life. And that to me means like we get busy. We get caught up in what we're doing. It seems so important. Must finish this, must finish that, must do that. Here's my bucket list. We're so caught up in our activities that we don't find time to practice. That's the problem with it, is that we have the precious human existence, we have everything we need to become awakened, and we don't do it for these four reasons. And the first one is too busy, too much stuff going on. Second one is, like, if we do manage to not be too busy from time to time, then we're too interested in various distractions. Like, what do? At the end of the work day, we turn on the TV. We surf our phone for hours. We there's so many diverges. We go out with friends for dinner. I don't know if people have read my notes online yet, but Sita Rinpoche has this lovely observation in his commentary on the Mahamudra Munlam, the third Paramahamsa Mahamudra Munlam, where he says, if you think that you will become enlightened by taking a hot bath and going to various restaurants and a couple of other things, he said, that's a ridiculous notion. So that's number two. It's like, we got to take the hot bath. We have to, you know, there's so many fun things or pleasant things we must do when we're not actually caught up in work. So that's number two. So all of this is about not finding time to practice. But then maybe you did find time to practice, but you practiced a path that, this is harking back to chapter one, Buddha Nature. Remember the five stages or the five degrees of manifestation of Buddha Nature. The first one's disconnected, like nobody would know you had a Buddha Nature at all, like from the way you act. Second one is sort of wishy-washy. I forget what the technical name for it is. Like whatever presents itself in front of you, you do that. Your friend is like, you know, I don't know what, new age person, so that's the way you go or whatever. And then the next day another friend is something else and you go that way. But then the next two, like the fifth one is the one that we're in Mahayana. And of course we take that as Mahayana. So we think that's like the best one. And it's about the Bodhisattva path, and the whole Mahayana path is about that. But there's a couple of valid paths before Mahayana, and it's called the hearers and the self-made Buddhas, the Shravakas and the Pratyeka Buddhas. And so that's what we're talking about in the third obstacle, is that you get stuck on that path. And it's a perfectly excellent path. It's the cultivation of wisdom. You realize emptiness, you free yourself from suffering, but then you forget that there's all these other people suffering. It's like verse 10 of the 37 practices. It's like, you have to go for full awakening. It's like, oh, my mothers, you know, oh, I'm, you know, I could free myself, but all of my mothers from previous lifetimes are still suffering. How can I leave them behind? I must get to work and set them free. So that's the piece that's missing from those two valid paths. And it leads to the piece of nirvana, not full awakening, but the nirvana of personal peace. So that's the third one. Is the third obstacle is, you're perfectly valid practitioner, you're making progress on the path. You can sit in meditative bliss for like days on end, but you forgot about everybody else. And so it's not full awakening yet. And it won't take you to full awakening. And that's the one in chapter one where it has that lovely passage where the Buddha sends a ray of light to wake them up gently. And he explains to them, you still got a little ways to go. But it's said that he created those paths for people who, like, for whom the whole thing is like just too overwhelming. So you give them like an island in the middle of the ocean that they can stop and rest for a while. You just don't want to stay there forever. So too busy, too caught up in distraction and pleasure, and then too caught up in your own personal peace. Then the fourth one, and that's the one that's really key right here. That's one we're solving now, starting now. Actually, we're solving them all starting now. Forget that. The fourth is ignorance of the path that leads to Buddhahood. So it's just not knowing how to travel the path, not knowing how to be a bodhisattva, not having the instructions to wake up. So all of these obstacles are solved in the antidote to the fourth obstacle, ignorance of the path, because we embark upon the path by solving the first one. So Rinku Tulku says, nonetheless, an experienced spiritual friend's instructions should help us overcome all four of them. So this is why we need a teacher to help us step by step, systematically break through all of these four obstacles. So Rinku Tulku explains, there is a specific antidote for each obstacle. Meditating on impermanence allows us to shed the feeling of being overly attached to the experiences of this life. Or as Dr. Wong, the Vietnamese doctor that you know many of us know in Vermont, as he said to someone years ago, the work will still be there when you die. It's like you're not going to get it all done anyway. So if we take that perspective, we're going to die anyway, and the work is going to go on. It becomes sort of less pressing to try to solve it all in this lifetime. It's like you could go home at 5 o'clock and just leave the pile on your desk. So meditating on impermanence allows us to shed the feeling of being overly attached to the experiences of this life, to be too caught up in our busyness. So that's the first antidote to the first obstacle. Second antidote, contemplating and understanding the nature of samsara and its inherent sufferings, as well as karma and its results, that's two chapters, helps us to reduce our attachment to the sensual pleasures of this world. That's what inspires you to turn off the TV. You realize the TV is suffering too. That's just another kind of suffering, is sitting and binge watching something on TV. And it's not really bringing you happiness after all. And then you think of like the karmic consequences of even just of wasting your time. But on the other hand, you know, some of the things that we do for pleasure might actually harm others. So we could incur negative karma that way. So that's antidote two. Nature of samsara and its inherent sufferings, karma and its results, that turns our attention away from just seeking our own pleasure, our own temporary pleasure. And then third one, by developing loving kindness and compassion, we can overcome the egotistical wish to find the peace of meditation and nirvana and to get out of samsara alone, just for ourselves. If we see the logic of compassion, we will naturally try to attain enlightenment in order to help other beings. So that's the first three obstacles taken care of. And the fourth obstacle, not knowing how to do it. Lastly, developing bodhicitta dissipates our ignorance of how to become Buddhist. So following the step-by-step path, bodhisattva path of cultivating bodhicitta, is how we overcome the fourth obstacle of not knowing how to do it. And that's all of the instructions in all of the chapters up until the last two, through chapter 20, are about that. They're the instructions. So in a way, all the instructions of the Buddha and the teachers who followed him are included in these four topics. If you know the four obstacles, then you know why you're following the path and you know what the purpose of the path is. And if you know the antidotes, that's the content of the path. Of these four recommendations, the fourth is the most important. Dispelling ignorance of how to wake up. According to Mahayana Buddhism, bodhicitta includes all the methods and techniques of the Buddhist path. Every teaching of the Buddha is related either to the cause of bodhicitta or the way to attain it, or its results, or else to bodhicitta itself. There is no Buddhist teaching that is not linked to bodhicitta in one way or another. Anybody have any questions or comments? All right, we will continue. Now we are on to impermanence. That was the introduction to the rest of the book, basically. So now we're entering into the antidote to the first obstacle to awakening, the first reason we're not Buddha, too caught up in our worldly preoccupations and activities. So Buddha said that everything compounded is impermanent. This is really key, and you don't find an explanation very often of what it means when they say things are conditioned or compounded. So this is it. First of all, everything compounded is impermanent. That's important to remember. And so what does that mean, compounded or conditioned? Everything that isn't made of one single substance, but is made of different elements coming together, must by its very nature fall apart. It is a natural law. There is no substance that is not composite. So here he's using another word, same thing, compounded or composite. Sometimes it's called conditioned. There is no substance. There's nothing that we encounter in this world that will not be that will not fall apart, because it's made of things that are brought together, put together. As a result, everything in this world is impermanent. So we can just contemplate that for a moment. I mean, we all know that, right? Intellectually, everything's impermanent. But if you just sit with that, like that could be like a little meditation instruction. Like, what would it be like to just sit with that knowledge, just explore that knowledge through meditation? Everything we will ever encounter is impermanent. So he elaborates, we can conclude that whoever is born will die, whatever is accumulated will be exhausted, whatever is built up will fall to ruin, and whoever come together will part sooner or later. Nothing compounded remains unchanged. This is why we must understand that everything is impermanent. So this is actually also in the Ornament of Precious Liberation. In this version, it's on page 48, right at the bottom of the page, if you're looking at the book. And here, quoting the collection of aphorisms. I mean, this is something that's called the four ends. It's like a thing. It's a four-line verse, the four ends. It's translated many different ways. The translation here, the end of all accumulation is dispersal. The end of construction is disintegration. The end of meeting is parting. And the end of life is death. That kind of covers everything. And I remember like a few years ago, walking through the, at that time, uncompleted. It was getting close to completion, but it wasn't completed yet, the splendid Maitreya Center at Kagyu Thubten Sholing Monastery. And I was walking through it with Lama Norla Rinpoche because I was escorting him. He was a little frail, and I was escorting him from the retreat house back to his room. And we detoured. He loved to detour and walk through the construction of the Maitreya Center. And he stopped and he said, one day this will be a ruin. This will fall down one day. It wasn't even built yet. So he was always thinking of impermanence. In fact, he said that. He said that of all the teachings that he got from his Root Lama, his original Root Lama in Tibet, the most important teaching, the teaching that had affected him the most, was impermanence. Just remember impermanence, he said. That's what his teacher told him. Remember impermanence. So the four ends are another thing that it's good to commit to memory if you have, you know, the wherewithal. So so back to Rinku Tulku towards the bottom of page 32. Contemplating impermanence is in fact considered the best meditation. Buddha said, of all footprints, those of the elephant are the broadest and the deepest. Similarly, of all meditations, that on impermanence is the strongest and the most beneficial. You could almost say that impermanence is the elephant in the room. That's how I remember that quote. It is. It really is the elephant in the room. It's the thing that's sort of unacknowledged in all of our relationships, in everything we do. It's like it's falling apart. It's coming to an end. So to continue with Rinku Tulku, if we understand impermanence at its deepest level, we also understand the philosophy of emptiness. I'm going to like recalibrate this a slight bit and just say the way that I understand this is that if you understand impermanence, then it's much easier to understand. You have a leg up basically on understanding emptiness, because they're the same thing, for understanding interdependence, understanding karma. If you understand impermanence, they all make a lot more sense. And we also understand the notion of rebirth and successive lives through understanding impermanence, like how the whole thing goes round and round again. You know, nothing is static. Another result of this understanding of impermanence, and this is really key, this is like why we understand impermanence, why we study, contemplate, and meditate on impermanence. Another result of this understanding of impermanence is that it will make us less attached to our present life, less unhappy, easier to live with, and more carefree and relaxed. And this brings to mind the first, I think it was the first year, and I was citing this in another class the other day, only a different part of it. First time Mingyur Rinpoche taught at KTC back in the early 2000s, he gave a teaching about the man in the lion suit. Anybody remember the man in the lion suit? Anne's nodding. That's one of my favorite teachings ever. He said that understanding impermanence and the other four reminders, understanding impermanence is like knowing that there's a man in a lion suit behind the door of the room that you're about to go into. He said, if you don't understand that there's a man in a lion suit behind the door, when you go through the door and he jumps out at you, you could have a heart attack. Like you could die because you think there's a lion. This is much more like probably common in Asia than it is in our urban environments. But you think that there was a lion really jumping out at you, and just that fear alone could kill you. But he said, if you know in advance that it's a man in a lion suit, then when you go through it, it's still going to startle you, but it won't take you completely by surprise. And so if you understand impermanence, then when we encounter death, when we encounter adversity, when we encounter illness, when we just encounter any reminder that things are not stable, it has less of an impact. We're prepared for it. So I think of it as the man in the lion suit. And impermanence, I think, is the big one. That's the real man in the lion suit behind every door that we ever go through. So to recap this sentence at the top of page 33, understanding impermanence will make us less attached to our present life. And that's obstacle one, right? Being too attached to our life and its activities. It will help us let go of that. It will make us less unhappy because we know it's a man in a lion suit and not a lion. Like, well, we knew that was coming. And it will make us easier to live with because we won't take things so seriously or expect them to remain the way that we want them. And it will make us more carefree and relaxed. So this is like the antidote to everything that bothers us. He says, in fact, most of the problems we encounter in this world come from the idea of permanence. Why do we fight with each other? Why are there so many conflicts between religions, countries, races, and so on? Because we believe that situations last, because we see them as permanent. It seems to us that everything can stay the way it is for a very long time, and that therefore we have to fight to change situations by force and win people over to our cause. But if we truly understood impermanence, we would not act that way. And again, to cite Lama Norla Rinpoche again, there were just so many times when I was on, you know, on staff, several of us here, but on staff at the monastery, and you see something as a problem and you go to Lama Norla Rinpoche and you think something needs to be done. And he says, just leave it alone. It will solve itself, you know, because everything is constantly changing. And he was right. You know, so often I would think, oh, we've got to do something about this situation. And he would say, no, just leave it alone. It'll take care of itself. Sometimes it doesn't. You have to know the difference. But so many things in life, because it's always changing, always falling apart, so many things do take care of themselves if we just relax. Okay, so we're going to skip a little bit ahead to, there are different methods for meditating on impermanence. And this is just beautifully structured in Ornament of Precious Liberation. So we obviously won't have time to go over that today in detail, if at all. But it's a very lovely structure. I'm going to read it from Rinku Tulku, where he doesn't really go through the structure of it. And if we have time, we'll just look at it briefly. But he does go over the different methods. So how do we meditate on impermanence? How do we contemplate impermanence? So the first way is to contemplate the impermanence of the outside world, going from general to specific, from sort of macrocosmic to microcosmic. Let's think about the world, the way it has changed since its beginning, its formation. Like, think of the whole universe here. Like, this universe wasn't always here. Even science, I think, says that. World systems is what it's called in Buddhism, usually. That's how we say it. World systems come and go over very, very long periods, so we're not so aware of it. This is a level of impermanence that we can only contemplate intellectually, except I guess now, right now, in our history right now, like everything kind of really is falling apart. So I guess we're getting a pretty good close-up view of how, like, climate can change, the glaciers can melt, the, you know, Arctic ice can melt, sea levels can rise, the weather can change, become hostile to human life. So we might be seeing it, like we might be at one of those sort of crux points where we're actually seeing the destruction of a world system. So let's think about the world, the way it has changed since its beginning, its formation, its evolution, and how it will eventually disintegrate. This earth, the sun, the moon, everything will one day be completely destroyed. Even the galaxies, the planets, the stars come into being, evolve, and die. So on that huge scale, which is generally beyond our immediate, like, perception, things are constantly changing. Even on that huge scale. Yes, Anne, I'm going to unmute you. Yeah.
I happened to watch a show last night on PBS about the end of the dinosaurs.
Ah, yes.
It was perfect. You know, they inhabited the entire globe from the Arctic to the Antarctic. They were just all over the whole world. And the asteroid hit, and in one day, the entire world caught on fire. In one day.
Yeah. You know,
and they were gone.
Yeah.
And the whole West was a jungle before that. A verdant
wow.
jungle. I know. Yeah. It was really good time to see it, when I was reading this chapter.
Yeah, the dinosaurs were probably very caught up in their day-to-day activities, too. They didn't know that an asteroid was going to come and wipe them out. They thought it was going to last, their dynasties would last forever.
Right.
Well, I actually have that note. I have a note in my book, Dinosaurs, but I, in the interest of saving time, I didn't say that today. So I'm glad that you brought that up. I mean, we're the dinosaurs now. We're the owners of the earth who are, you know, something's coming. We can't take it for granted. So there's that level of change. And that's what Gampopa calls gross impermanence. So that's one level of impermanence he asks us to contemplate, is gross impermanence. Like, just think about it. Like, worlds come and go. And then there's the next level down, which he calls subtle impermanence, which is what Rinku Chulku is going to describe here. He says there are not only large changes on that scale, but also a multitude of small changes. And so what this is Gampopa asks us to contemplate these three ways that impermanence manifests in a more subtle way. The first one is the succession of seasons. You know, it's winter right now, but it will be spring, and then it will be summer, and then it will be fall, and then it will go around. I mean, Christmas was just here. Like I remember the brand new shiny year of 2018. Like, oh, well, you know, it just seems like it's just spreading out forever. It's all the time in the world, and then suddenly it's Christmas, and then suddenly Christmas is gone, and it's a new year. And so, you know, the daffodils are just waiting to push up now under the ground. So we can pay attention to that. It's like what Gampopa says is it's worth paying attention to that. It's a reminder. It keeps us from ever taking anything as solid and permanent if we remember the seasons and just notice that change gradually happening. Next one is to notice the cycle of day and night. You know, like, oh, it's sunrise again, but very soon it will be sunset again. And then you'll go to sleep, it'll all be dark, and then it's going to get light again. And you can really notice that as well. I mean, it's really worth paying attention. And then the third one is time never stops, as Rinku Chulku puts it. Gampopa calls it moment-to-moment impermanence. And actually, Kala Rinpoche has a really beautiful expression of that, which we're going to read. It's taken from Gampopa. It's just a slightly different phrasing of the same thing. It's very beautiful expression of moment-to-moment impermanence. So time never stops. Each moment, the Romans knew that, right? Tempus fugit, time flees. They didn't even say time flies. They said time flees. Each moment brings something new. Nothing stays motionless. Everything changes all the time. Contemplating and understanding this motion is meditating on the impermanence of the outside world, like all of these things. So that, according to Gampopa's structure, that is the impermanence of, that's the impermanence of the world, like of the container, what's called the container, of the outer environment in all of these coarse and subtle ways that it manifests. So now the second big category of impermanence of is beings, looking at the impermanence of beings such as ourself. So Ringu Tulku says at the very bottom of page 33, now let's look at the beings who inhabit the earth. We see them be born, grow old, and die, which should remind us of our own impermanence. And in Gampopa, that's like, it's a long passage with a lot of specific ways in which we always should remind ourselves of our own impermanence through the impermanence of others. Ringu Tulku says, death is how impermanence reveals itself the most strikingly to us. The contemplation of death helps us fully realize what impermanence means. Everyone, absolutely everyone, must die. That's one of the nine contemplations. Everybody dies. Also in the, it's one of the major categories, there's five major categories of impermanence in Torch of Certainty, right? Anybody read that recently? Like everybody dies. That's the first contemplation under impermanence. Even if, the, and then the uncertainty of the time of death, even if there is no certainty as to the time of our death, there is absolutely no doubt that we will have to die and that nothing at all will be able to stop this process. And as you get older, I can tell you, as you get older, this becomes a more and more vivid contemplation. It's like any time now it could happen. And nothing can stop it. Like the aging process, nothing. You really appreciate that as you get older, like nothing can stop it. Why can nothing stop it? It is important to remind ourselves that we can die at any moment. Nagarjuna once said, and he was like one of the great Buddhist Mahasiddhas of long ago. He once said, if I breathe out and do not breathe in again, I am dead. Isn't it marvelous to think that even while I am sleeping at night, I do not stop breathing, and in the morning I am still alive? And it is true. Life is so precarious that if we breathe out and do not breathe back in again, we are dead. Did you ever get a piece of food stuck in your throat? And you literally could not breathe in? I mean, people die that way. That's happened to me a couple of times. Like, there's just nothing happening with the breath. And you realize, like, I'm right there on the brink. Hopefully it takes care of itself or somebody can do the Heimlich maneuver. But it's that simple. You swallow something slightly wrong and you're just gone. It's like flatline. I don't mean to laugh, but, you know, it's true. It could be, I mean, people die in ridiculous ways sometimes. I mean, that's kind of a ridiculous way to die. It's like you're eating a cracker and that's it. That's the end of the road. We can also apprehend how fragile, there was a French philosopher whose name is escaping me at the moment. I was like French literature major, and he was hit by some kind of a funny truck, you know, like a diaper truck or something like that. And it was observed of him that he died in the most ridiculous possible way. And I was like, I thought of 10 better, like more ridiculous ways to die when I read that. But I was knitting at the time, and I thought, well, you could impale yourself on your knitting needle. Anyway, we could go on, like there's many endless riffs on that topic, but back to Ringu Tulku. We can also apprehend how fragile our existence is by reminding ourselves that our body is composed of many parts and substances and is therefore very unstable. Again, many things come together to make this life happen. And if any one of them like ceases, we're looking into the mouth of death. Our life is decreasing every moment and nothing increases it. And so Gampopa uses, I think, three examples. I don't think that they're all here. Three examples of, like, there are three metaphors for the inexorability of, like, the trajectory of our life, like, to the end, the inevitability of death. And the first one is like an arrow shot by an archer. once the arrow is shot, nothing stops it. It continues on its way toward the target without ever stopping. In the same way, every passing second brings us inexorably closer to death. A teacher that I studied with many years ago, used to see, he was a Western teacher, talking about impermanence, he said, you already fell off the building. Like once you're born, you already fell off the building. You're hurtling towards your death. I always loved that image because it's true. Fortunately, it feels like a slow, like, hurdle at the moment. But I think when you get to the end, it might as well have been instantaneous. It feels faster and faster, like that hurdling as you get older. So in the causes of death are numerous, whereas there are few to support life. That's also a line from Torch of Certainty. Even the factors that generally sustain our life, like medicine and food, can sometimes cause our death. Wrong dosage, wrong drug, allergy, interaction of drugs. Like people die all the time, like all the time in hospitals from those things. Things that are supposed to save their life, kill them. Life is fragile because we can die at any moment. Youth, health, a desirable social position, wealth, numerous friends, and fame are no guarantee, no protection against death. We must understand and accept. So let's pause here. We must understand and accept that when death comes, nothing, no outer or inner force can stop it. We should take this fact into consideration, and from now on, our actions should not only aim at the well-being of our body in this life, but also have a much longer-term goal. There is no doubt that our life will come to an end and that we will die. Trying to ignore this would be madness. It is better to face reality than to hide behind the illusion that no change will affect us or that everything will sort itself out. Too often people consider that thinking about death is sinister and depressing. I just want to go back though and say that this is the important point, is like understanding impermanence is about how we're going to spend the rest of our life from this moment forward, as it says in the four reminders. From this moment on, I will make my life meaningful, because you understand that you already fell off the building. And so everything that you do counts and is of utmost importance. You don't want to waste your life once you truly realize that it's impermanent and that nothing will stop that process and that you might not find this opportunity again. It changes how you spend your life. So that's his advice here, is take it in and change how you're relating to everything. And mainly that first obstacle. Remember the first obstacle that this is all about? Don't get so caught up that you don't have time for Dharma practice, for study, contemplation, and meditation. Like, don't let it get away. So back to the final paragraph on 34. Too often people consider that thinking about death is sinister and depressing, that it is better not to talk or even think about it. I doubt that anybody who's here today has that point of view. But he's talking about people who do, and we certainly encounter people who don't want to talk about such things. Some people go so far as to believe that simply talking about it brings bad luck, like a jinx or something. The deaths of others frighten us and make us feel insecure because they remind us of what we all know, even if we wish to forget it. Nonetheless, examining the subject more thoroughly will not make us more unhappy or depressed. On the contrary, we will be more at peace, because if we really face this reality, we will understand it more deeply and behave accordingly in our daily lives. It's the man in the lion suit. You want to know the man in the lion suit is behind the door. You don't want to walk through the door unawares. So then he tells a little story, which I'm not going to read the whole thing, about the family whose son died. And the neighbors came to express condolences and found the family perfectly happy, like nothing wrong here. And it was because they know that life is impermanent. They were prepared for it. They knew the man in the lion suit was behind the door. They were prepared. And they said, we all treated each other well. We have nothing to regret. We never hurt him or did him any wrong during his life. So that's why we're still happy and peaceful. And Lama Norla Rinpoche talked about that some, you know, that, you know, that Yeah, I'm not sure how to put this. That doesn't sound sort of... it's something that we could take in stride. Like we know that death is going to claim everybody, so it doesn't have to be like emotionally devastating. Obviously, we're going to feel emotions. Marfa cried when his son died. And somebody said, I thought we were supposed to have no attachment. And he said, he was a really extraordinary son. We feel the emotion. So again, it's like we take it as like a dream and we understand. We knew in advance that this is how it all ends. So whatever emotions we may feel, we just don't need to get completely caught up in them. We don't need to be derailed by it. And this family was even able to be happy, remain happy and take completely in stride when their son died. So Rinpoche says, the simple story shows very well that the understanding of impermanence and death shouldn't make anyone unhappy, quite the contrary. Many people who have gone through near-death experiences say that they now appreciate life much more because they have understood impermanence. If we are not confronted with death, we don't value our life. Our small daily problems seem so important that we usually forget how precious life itself is. Whereas when we confront death, those small problems become terribly insignificant. And I think that's always true. Somebody dies and you realize how trivial most of the things you usually are upset by really are. There's this big blip on the radar that is like, you're going to die. Everybody's going to die. And if you remember that, it puts everything else into perspective. He says, if we truly deeply understand that everything is impermanent and transitory, our attachment to this life will diminish, obstacle one, and our faith in the Dharma will grow. What's that? That's verse 3 of 37 practices. I think so. We will be motivated to diligently practice the path leading out of the sufferings of samsara. Understanding impermanence will also help us to get less involved in attachment and aversion, just not taking everything so seriously. We will have a broader general approach, be more open-minded, and become wiser in a way. We will not make mountains out of molehills anymore. I hope so. We will stop getting involved in petty arguments, which are a sign of a narrow and irritable mind, and will not let ourselves be affected and disturbed by small things. These are all the benefits. The last section of Gampopa is also the benefits of understanding impermanence. Rinpoche Tulku goes into a bit more detail in sort of more Western terms. We will take highs and lows, happiness and unhappiness less seriously because we know everything's always changing. In a nutshell, this clearer and more detached view of the world of samsara will reduce our psychological problems. And that's as far as we're going to read in Rinpoche Tulku. He tells another story that we don't, you can read it on your own, but we don't need to go over it now. Does anybody have any questions or comments? I'm hoping to read the Kala Rinpoche briefly and a couple of things, short things from Gampopa, but if anybody has anything they would like to say, we can do that first. Okay. So I think first we will do Kala Rinpoche, writings of Kala Rinpoche. It's basically the same. Oh, sorry, Lama Jinzong. Okay. You can unmute yourself.
Okay, but Dave had his hand up.
Oh, I'm sorry. Thank you. Over to you, Dave. You are unmuted now.
I was just noticing in linguistics, this is a thing that I found was really interesting. Our language kind of subverts the understanding of impermanence because, like, if you look at subject and object and how you have to talk about things and then even think about them, you always need to congeal things into something. And so the idea that everything's flying apart or whatever is not natural to that kind of thinking. So I don't know. That's just something. Yeah. It's like when you're walking on something, you don't notice it because it's essential for everything that you think about. It's so low level. And so that's just something that comes back and back. Subject and object, and then impermanence. You know, we have to really unpack that all the time because it's like right there. Like, you can't even talk properly without a subject and object. Yeah. And some sorts of permanence.
Yeah, so, without solidifying things into a dualistic point of view, in short. Yeah, thank you.
Yeah, and there's something called the Sapir-Whorf hypothesis in anthropology, where they talk about, like, reality is constructed by language. So I don't know, you might have heard of that. Same kind of thing.
Yeah, yeah. Yes, everything in our language, everything in our culture promotes this perception of things as solid and lasting, discrete. Yeah, thank you. Anybody else? Yes, Mark, go ahead.
I was actually listening to a commentary on Gampopa impermanence, and the idea was that if things are impermanent, it kind of makes you appreciate the beauty of them, mm-hmm. like a flower doesn't last very long, and the sunset doesn't last very long, so that kind of thing is part of it too.
Yeah, yes, very good point. Yeah, and those things help you tune into, like, momentary experience as well. Okay, thank you. Anybody else? Yes, Deidre.
This goes to a little bit of what Dave was talking about, because for me, even I can get so used to reading these teachings that that other things outside of them somehow are allowable to be more permanent, you know. Mm-hmm. Okay, so like right now you can look at England, which is actually falling apart. You know, it's a huge country. And the same thing could happen to this country, but that's not somehow in our awareness. You know, it's okay for me to die, but what if instead it was total chaos? You know, because all of a sudden the whole fabric of the country is falling apart.
Yeah.
So you see what I'm saying? It's like it kind of we're like, that's what Dave was saying, you have to unpack it every day, but in all ways, in so many different ways.
Yeah.
So, yeah.
Yes, I think that's the beauty of having it as a contemplation, like, and having the different levels of it. I mean, I think that's what Gampopa is getting at when he says, look at gross impermanence, like whole worlds can end. Look at more subtle impermanence, the seasons and the, you know, changing of night to day. And then the most subtle level of impermanence, the moment to moment impermanence. And then you look at everything. You can look at everything through that filter to whatever extent you're able to keep it in mind. And I think that's why Lama Norla Rinpoche said that was the most, that's a teaching that affected him the most, was remember impermanence, just the simplicity of remember impermanence. And he said also that when Kala Rinpoche, like the first Kala Rinpoche, used to come to visit New York City, people would take him to, like, the circus, you know, always looking for some, like, they would take Lama Norla Rinpoche in the 70s to the Star Wars movies and things like that. They're trying to find something sort of fun to introduce them to. And Rinpoche said that Kala Rinpoche, he enjoyed the circus, but all the time he was watching it, he was seeing impermanence. You know, it was just, everything was just a reminder of impermanence, even like pleasant things you think. And that's verse 23, I think, of the 37 practices, that when you see something like a rainbow, right, you see something pleasant, any pleasant experience that we encounter, like the rainbow is the example that's given, it doesn't say see it as impermanent, but it says see it as illusory. It might say see it as not lasting. Don't remember all the details now, but that's how we're supposed to relate to pleasant experiences. And again, it's the man in the lion suit behind the door. If you relate to it that way, instead of getting caught up in it, then you won't be devastated when it stops. And I think that speaks to what Mark was saying, that things like sunsets, things, you know, all these experiences that are lovely and enchanting, for example, but we know that they're very, very temporary and fleeting, helps us be in that state of mind. So we could look at anything. We could look at, like, getting the perfect job as a rainbow or a sunset, like, it's same nature. It's just a little slower, hopefully, you know, trajectory to ending. Anybody else have anything? I think we only got a few minutes left. So I think I'm going to make an executive decision that we'll do another week on impermanence, just because we have some lovely materials, and also give Lama Jinzong an extra week to prepare for. I don't know if she needs an extra week. but to forever the next chapter. Any comments, Lama Jinzong? You're unmuted.
I'm happy mostly because, you know, I know what's coming up with the writings of Kala Rinpoche, and if it gets us a chance to actually meditate during the sessions on the on
yes,
the,
excellent idea.
You know, we've sort of been going through it now, but it's really about really resting and contemplating it. So I'm just putting my hand up saying, yeah, I wouldn't mind a little bit of that. But I also have one comment, if I may, about
this.
Oh, you know, I think that it's interesting because you're supposed to recognize that when you realize that, you know, these thoughts you have are fleeting and then you can let them go. And then, you know, they say nothing then can be so unbearable because you know that it's just temporary, blah, blah. But I'm just looking at my mind recently, which, you know, I've been suffering a bit of depression because of what's going on with the country in terms of, you know, Russia's controlling our president, whatever it is. I mean, like the point being that we're seeing like feeling a level of despair in my mind and at seeing that constantly wanting to have some faith that there's something that's stable. You know, like that is the nature of feeling okay, is that there's something stable. And I don't mean, so it's interesting because seeing the way things are going right now and, you know, the government, you know, people are having to work without pay. I mean, to me, it's not just that I want it to be stable, but that somehow it to be okay, like to be able to be okay. I mean, I know that, yes, this is transitory and change will come, but like it's going on for so long, you know, like the shutdown, it's like going on and on, like to be able to let that go and the fear. And yeah, you know, it's just so important for our well-being to have this sense that things are stable. You know, and in a good way. It just, it's so, that's why it's so, I know for a fact that, you know, certain people that say that it's very hard for them to meditate on the idea that there, you know, is no ultimate self or whatever, because it's so frightening that there's this idea that, you know, without a sense of stability. So it's just interesting because, you know, the shutdown thing, I'm like, yes, it's impermanent. Yes, it will change, whatever. But in the moment, it is so hard not to feel fear and upset and I don't know. I'm just blabbing anyway.
Yeah. So if we can't find stability in the outer world, like where do we find it? No, it is hard. I personally, like when I get caught up in things like that, I just think of all the historical events I have personally lived through and they came to an end. You thought they were going to last forever. Like Nixon, for example, you thought, you know, what's going to happen? I mean, it was really quite harrowing.
True enough.
Nobody knew how Watergate would come out. We could all have been in jail. I mean, I had friends who ended up in jail in protest. So, but it's, I mean, who even remembers now, except that it's kind of vivid at the moment.
But I guess I just wanted to say, like, you know, that the part of this is our culture, or just who we are. I don't even know if it's our culture, but this idea that for to maintaining the illusion of there being something that's stable, that we, that's something we can control, is just totally the crux of our suffering, that we can't control and giving up control, except for how we respond to our own thoughts.
And as Dave points out, it's just built in. It's built into all the systems that we, you know, we rely on. So we'll talk more about that next week. That's a good theme for next week, and some meditation and contemplation. We still got some lovely materials, which now I'm happy that we'll have time to spend a little more time with, and we can go through a little bit Gampopa's structure too, and we can use that as a meditation because it's set up that way. So we got like 1 minute left. Anybody have any final parting comments before we do our prayers? Yes, Dave.
I just want to ask, what is the title of that Kala Rinpoche text again?
Writings of Kala Rinpoche. And, you know, I don't know where you would find a copy in this day and age. Steve suggested eBay, perhaps.
Thank you.
It's a very tiny, tiny book. This is like published in 1976. And I, you know, I mean, there's so many, this was like published in a time when there weren't a lot of authentic, you know, books about the path like this. but now there's lots. So this one's maybe fallen into disuse a little bit, but looking at it for this, I was actually, the reason I found it was because there's a particular passage in Kampopa, a particular expression of impermanence. And I was like, I know Kala Rinpoche said something about that. And it was a quote that I just loved so much. I actually had it with me in 3-year retreat. I looked at it all the time and I was like, where is that? And I found it in writings of Kala Rinpoche. So we'll have that to look forward to for next week.
I was, right. Another thing that was kind of relevant, I didn't think it would be, but on the, like a kind of getting into a definition of compounded existence, mm-hmm. in the Thich Nhat Hanh book that somebody recommended in the 12 Links class, I can't remember who.
Oh, but yeah. Mm-hmm.
But that Thich Nhat Hanh, I think it's the something of the Buddha, like the heart of teachings or something.
I can look it up. I'm looking it up. I wrote it down, so I'll look it up as you're talking.
But there was just a great, like on the dependent origination, it talked about the co-arising, right? So
yeah.
it was very similar to, like, you know, kind of like what I was getting at about how our language and everything has to imply permanence in order to work, this definition of co-arising. And so mm-hmm. getting at that everything is compounded, meaning that as you break it down, there's nothing there, and that's like how impermanence is emptiness. So anyway, the discussion in that was just really good. I was like, wow, this is cool.
Yeah. So the book by Thich Nhat Hanh is Heart of the Buddha's Teachings. It was recommended by somebody in another class on the topic of the 12 links, which is sort of how it all works. I'm unmuting you, Joanne.
Yeah, I just want to tell Dave that unlike the writings of Kala Rinpoche, that particular book is on Kindle and on Amazon.
All right. Okay, thank you.
You're welcome.
All right, I think we'd best do our prayers now because people might have places they have to go. Let's see where I put my prayers. Okay. All right, so we'll do the 4 verses of dedication. Making sure I have everybody muted. Yes, okay. All right, so let's take a moment to bring our minds to rest again from all of this mental activity. And focus on our intention to share any benefit from this study, meditation, and contemplation with all sentient beings towards their enlightenment. This merit may it win omniscience, defeat my faults the enemy, then from the rough and stormy sea of birth, old age, death, and disease, from this ocean of samsara, may I liberate all beings. They know things in their true existence, Kuntu, Zangpo, and Manjushri. To train myself in their example, I dedicate this practice fully. May every being through this practice completely gather merit and wisdom, attaining the 2 sacred bodies that merit and wisdom emanate, the blessings of the Buddhakayas, the blessings of changeless dharmata, the blessings of the steadfast sangha, this dedication please fulfill. And back to rest just for a moment. And you're all unmuted.
Thank you, everyone. I have to go. Bye-bye.
Okay. Bye-bye. See you next week for more on impermanence, and then we'll be on to the sufferings of samsara, I think, next week. Okay, bye, everybody.
Bye.
Bye-bye.
Bye. Bye. Bye.